Topic is the mind. I'm talking about the mind, right? And I'm sure by now you've made friends with your mind, but in case you haven't, we will continue. So, Pancharatna Das is going to ask some questions.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Mahatma. So yeah, I'm very excited about what we're working on, offering bhakti life to whoever we can offer it to. So tell us a little bit. What are we doing with bhakti life? What's it offering to, say, the visitors at Krishna.com?
Okay, Pancharatna is asking, what are we doing with bhakti life? What is bhakti life? And what do we teach and why did we develop it? Bhakti life began, in my mind, probably in the 80s. And I saw that many people would come to temples and they would come to the Sunday lectures, but and they get a little something out of it, but they needed more. And we didn't really have courses and workshops and classes for them. You'd come to a Sunday lecture, they weren't coming with notes, notebooks and books. It wasn't a study session. And I thought, we need to do something more. And I also saw that a lot of people just came to chant. They weren't that interested in listening to a lecture. It wasn't really always interesting, that interesting, or fun, or provocative or just compelling for them, or wasn't relating enough to their life. And I thought, we need to do something that relates to people's life, and we need to do something in which people can explore spiritual life from their own perspective rather than just be told what it is. So that was back in the 80s. It began simmering in my mind, and I saw how other organizations were gradually doing this. And then I was in London about 5-6 years ago, and in London Temple, many, many people come to the temple, and I thought, these people would love to have a course in bhakti. They're interested, and I would say hundreds and hundreds of people come to that temple every day. There's always people there. So gradually this idea developed in my mind, and recently Pancharatna was asking me, well, how do we help people who want to come to Krishna consciousness? It doesn't seem like we really have anything, you know. We don't have an introductory course, we don't have introductory audio books. And I said, yes, I have this idea. So we began working together. And so I began thinking, if someone is new to Krishna consciousness, what would be the best way they could learn about it? And I thought, well, let's develop a course that's highly interactive, very provocative, very introspective, and really get people to look at their lives, look at their relationship with God. And I began developing a course that would take place through an entire weekend, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, which would go through all the basics of bhakti in a way which would be fun, a way which would be impactful, revealing, and motivating for people to continue. That was my idea. So we developed three levels of courses. The first level of course is for people who know little or nothing about bhakti and who want to get a comprehensive understanding and also learn about the practices so they can employ them. So that's called the level one course. And that's for if you are just coming to Krishna consciousness or just beginning spiritual life or just beginning to learn about Indian philosophy, Eastern spirituality, or just coming to the beginnings of bhakti, this course is for you. You'll get a comprehensive understanding in a way you can take with you and apply to your life and apply to the problems that you face in life. Bhakti course level two, that's for people who are already practicing. So if you come to bhakti level one, you'll learn the practices. And then if you want to improve those practices and learn more how to apply those practices to real life situations and become steady in those practices, you'll take the level two course, which is also a weekend. And level three, if you are seriously practicing bhakti, level three is for you. And it will help you re-examine your practices, re-examine your beliefs, your commitments. Look at your chanting. Look at what you're doing, but look at it from a different angle. So you can understand it in a way that it doesn't become hackneyed. A lot of times when we do bhakti after a period of time, it becomes hackneyed. We become bored with it. We take it for granted. We hit a threshold we can't seem to get through. Bhakti level three is for that, it's kind of like what a japa retreat is to japa. We look at our entire bhakti. So whatever level you're on, we have a course for you. In addition, we're developing other courses. We have the forgiveness course. We have a course on sexual purity. We have a course on the Gita. We have a course on prayer. So all these courses are there meant to help you in your spiritual life. And so our goal as facilitators is to facilitate you step by step on the path.
How are these courses going to be made available? How will we be able to take the courses?
So Pancharatna is asking how the courses are available. We're conceiving of the courses in four ways at this point. Online, and that online could be live and self-paced. Self-paced means there'll be homework that you do. And live means once a week we'll come together for an hour and a half session. And it'll be very interactive. And you'll actually be able to share with a group and share one-on-one with a partner through the online facility. We also conceived of doing a course for those who can't be present at a specific time, doing an entirely self-paced course. We will also do live in-person courses, in other words, workshops, in the location near where you live. And we also will develop CD with a workbook or video with a workbook. So basically the video would be the workshop live videoed along with the workbook so you can do the exercises, and the audio would be the same thing without the video.
What's the personal services that come with the Bhakti course?
Personal services. One of the things that we offer is consultation, counseling, coaching. Everyone who takes the Bhakti course, if they want, will be put in touch with their personal coach, their mentor, so that devotee can guide them in their daily practices. They can talk to that devotee to deal with their problems, situations, questions, confusion.
Does taking the Bhakti course involve any sort of commitment to some religious organization? I mean, sounds like maybe it's some kind of indoctrination like that.
So Pancharatna is asking, is this an indoctrination course that you're being indoctrinated into loving God? That's the only indoctrination. Of course, no one can be indoctrinated against their will. We're not indoctrinating you. We're offering you understanding, principles, practices, which you are free to choose to apply or not apply as you find them useful. It's offering you different viewpoints and ways of looking at the world and looking at yourself, different spiritual practices that you can apply to your existing practice. If you do yoga or you have other spiritual path, you do meditation, you just add these practices and you decide. So this is the principle of the Bhakti course. Right in the beginning of the course, we tell people, you don't have to believe anything. Just be open, see what works for you, adopt it in your life, take it home. Whatever doesn't work, then that's fine also.
So, if I wanted to take one of these courses, then when is this going to happen? Is it already starting, or what can we?
When are they going to be available? So, well, the first courses we're launching are going to be online courses, and so if you are on Krishna.com email, then you're going to get an email and learn about it. And if you're not on Krishna.com email, please get on it. How do they get on it? Go to Krishna.com and
sign up
just to get on the Krishna.com email list. Because if you get on the email list, then you'll learn all the details about all the courses. Because Bhakti Life is the educational arm of Krishna.com. And we're going to be doing a whole series of courses and repeating these courses on a regular basis. So if you're on the mailing list, you'll always be aware of when the latest courses. If you can't do the next course, you can do the one after that, or the one after that, or the one next year. And you'll learn about all the other courses as we're developing them.
And is there any prerequisites? Is there something that I have to already be, you know, practicing something or be a spiritual person, or should I just take this course?
Okay. Do you have to be a spiritual person? Do you need some prerequisites to take the course? You have to be practicing anything? Well, the prerequisite is that you have to be a spiritual person. But don't worry, we're all spiritual persons. You cannot not be a spiritual person because you're a spirit soul. So you're fully qualified in the fact that you're a spiritual soul. Now, for the first course, level one, absolutely no prerequisite. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, this will bring you into the doorway of bhakti. And you'll learn the very basics from step one. If you're going to take the second level, then you should be practicing some of the practices of bhakti, which you may already know, or if not, you'll learn them in level two. And then level three, of course, is for those who are somewhat serious, those who are thinking about accepting a guru and more seriously applying the practices of bhakti. So level three are for the serious practitioners. And level one and two are more for, people may end in level one and two because they want to adopt some of the practices or adapt them to their current practices.
And who are these courses for? I mean, is it for people who know about bhakti terms? I mean, there's going to be a lot of Sanskrit in these courses confuse us if I don't know anything about it.
Ultimately, bhakti is for everyone because bhakti simply means devotion, devotion of the soul. And bhakti is natural. So if you don't know anything, you take level one from any position. All you have to do is understand and speak English. That's the only prerequisite. And you'll be guided through the practices. And what you'll find is that because bhakti is natural to the soul, you'll find it very similar to the fundamental teachings of most of the great spiritual and philosophical traditions that help us become spiritually advanced. But I think you'll find it goes a little deeper. You'll find it's extremely profound, logical. And I think most of all, you'll find the experience is greater and it's more accessible. You don't have to be some monk or nun, but right in your own home, you can have spiritual experiences immediately with the process of bhakti, with the chanting, and the exercises in which we facilitate you will help bring many deep realizations about who you are, why you're here, what you're doing with your life, what your purpose is. All extremely important questions for everyone of any religious faith to deal with and confront and answer.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you.
It is.
And so I know you have a talk to tell to your people.
Yes.
That have come here to hear you, and I don't want to take too much more of your time. But we're both looking forward to this online launch coming up. We're told that we'll be able to get it up and running by the registration by Janmashtami, the big festival coming up. So those of you who are on our mailing list, look out for the email that you'll be getting soon, and let us know if you're interested so we can give you more information.
I thought maybe it would be good to just kind of go over a little bit of what we talk about. And one of the things that I'm really excited about in the Bhakti course is the section on karma. Because the section on karma is so nice because it resolves a problem that many of us have. We look at the world and we see the world isn't perfect. It's not the way we'd really want it to be. If we could make the world any way we want it, we would change some things. We wouldn't want suffering. We wouldn't want fighting. We wouldn't want disease. We wouldn't want old age. We wouldn't want death. And so when we look at the world, we think, okay, this world's not perfect. Something's wrong. But there's God. Why did God create a world this way? And God is supposed to be a loving God. And many people either become agnostic or just become confused or atheistic. And so when we understand karma, we see karma, when something bad happens to us, karma is actually the language of God. God's actually talking to us through the suffering. Because often if we don't suffer, we don't look for deeper meaning. We don't ask these important questions. Why am I here? Why is there suffering? So when bad things happen to us, if we learn how to read the language and the lessons that suffering brings, we gain deep realization. And this is so important because it resolves this conflict that so many of us have, in that we can't make sense of a world of suffering and a loving God. And so we see the suffering actually is the hand of God pushing us a little bit more to the lessons we need to learn. And so I've seen how much this helps people. And we do various exercises that will help you realize in your life how much suffering has made you a stronger person, how much you've learned from it, and how those experiences have been necessary to bring you where you are today. So that's a very important part. Another important part of the Bhakti course is we talk about happiness. And happiness is a very interesting subject because so many of us are looking for it and we're not doing it. Most of us are doing a pretty bad job of getting it. And so we look at happiness in great detail. We compare material happiness to spiritual happiness. And one of the things that we learn in our exploration of material happiness, when I say material happiness, I mean happiness based on having things or sensual gratification, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, like that, hearing. One of the things we realize is that often in our attempt to become happy, we undergo a lot of painful experiences to get it. It's not just happiness comes discreetly or in a vacuum. We just get the happiness and we don't pay a price for it. Often we pay dearly for it. And oftentimes the pleasure is not really worth the pain. There's a pleasure-pain ratio. And if the pain ratio is way down here on the scale, there's a lot of pain, but the pleasure may not be worth it. And sometimes we get pleasure and there is no pain, but later on pain comes. We're very happy in a relationship. We're very happy in a job. Something goes wrong. The boss doesn't like us. He's hard on us. Our girlfriend, our boyfriend, our spouse cheats on us, leaves us. The relationship turns sour. So the pain turns sour. So it's not pure. It's not perfect because it's dependent on something. Or even if the happiness is good, oftentimes we have to sacrifice so much to get it that we may question, is it worth it? Spiritual happiness is so much different because by nature, that's who we are. We are blissful by nature. We are looking for something outside of ourselves, which is within ourselves. So one of the greatest gifts of the Bhakti course is that it enables us to experience what we call in Sanskrit ananda or bliss or spiritual pleasure, which is our own birthright as spiritual beings. You in the book Bhagavad Gita, many of you have heard of Bhagavad Gita, one of the texts we use in the Bhakti course. It says that when one gets to this position where he experiences the spiritual pleasure, he thinks, or she thinks, there's nothing greater than this. I mean, how often do you experience that? You get your latest 4G iPhone, you don't think, there's nothing greater than this. You're waiting for the 5G. We never think there's nothing. And even if we think there's nothing greater, we soon learn there is something greater because it doesn't deeply satisfy us. So when we come to the spiritual platform, then we actually have this experience that there's nothing greater than this. Now, how valuable is that? Consider our whole life. It's just our life is a series of actions, of thoughts of how to be happy. And we're not really good at it. In America, we were rated about the 45th happiest nation in the world. We're really bad at it because we're obsessed with accumulation. We're obsessed with the concept of we don't have enough. So this is such a valuable part of the Bhakti course. We go very deep into this whole concept, how we've been programmed. We don't have enough, more is better, and we're madly running around to accumulate more and more. And there's this big hole in our heart, and we're trying to put things in to satisfy, and it doesn't work. So I find that a really, really valuable aspect of the Bhakti course. Another valuable aspect of the Bhakti course, which relates to this, is the idea of how consciousness is the real determinant of how happy we are. Because a person who is envious, a person who is angry, a person who is unkind, a person who is resentful, they can't be happy because they carry those toxic qualities within their consciousness. So wherever they go, they're carrying this anger, this hatred, this envy, this jealousy. You know what it's like when you're envious of someone. It brings no happiness at all. It just brings pain to the heart. So if you're an envious person, if you're an unkind person, you have a big house. Does the big house make you happy? No, because you're carrying your consciousness into the house. You're carrying that hatred, that anger, that resentment, that jealousy, that envy, wherever you go. So your effort to be happy is really an effort to forget how you feel, to numb it. And isn't that what we do with intoxication? Just, you know, drink our way dumb so we forget what life is really like. So much of our happiness is an effort to forget what's really going on in our life, to forget the pain in our life. That's not happiness. Forgetting your pain is not happiness. That's just the absence of pain. That's like if I hammered your toe, and then mystically I relieved the pain. And I said, how does your toe feel? You'd say, it feels great. Your toe doesn't feel great. Your toe didn't feel great before I hit it. It just, relatively, it feels great because there's no more pain. Now, the other side of that, what are the higher levels of consciousness? Compassion, kindness, forgiveness, integrity, honesty, tolerance. If we possess those qualities, then what if we don't have a big house? Does it matter? We don't have a big car. We don't have so-called success, material success, is that going to bother us? No. Is there anything wrong with those things? Not necessarily. But the idea is, if we have higher consciousness, wherever we go, we carry that consciousness with us. That's what we experience. So if we don't have the material side the way we are told by society it should be to make us happiness, it's irrelevant. Our happiness does not depend on that. So this is such an important realization. And we help people in the Bhakti course develop or experience those higher qualities because those higher qualities are natural. They're inherent within the soul. We have so many good qualities. Some people have issues. They don't like themselves. Or they have issues with self-esteem, or they do things they don't like. If you understand your spirit soul, then you look at yourself and go, hey, I'm really cool. I'm a blissful person. I'm eternal. I'm full of knowledge. I have all these good qualities. I'm a compassionate person. I'm a tolerant person. I'm a forgiving person. I'm an honest person. These are qualities of the soul. So these sections of the Bhakti course, I find that in my teaching, that people get so much benefit from this because our whole life is just a struggle to be happy. And we go about it in such a wrong way. And our whole life is a struggle to make sense of purpose, of why we're here. And in what we do in Bhakti is we broaden that perspective. So you're not just looking at right here, now, this life, the next few years, but you're looking at your whole existence beyond the physical. And the other thing that people really get from the Bhakti course that's very, very profound is that they begin to understand the difference between the body and the soul. And many of us have heard that. We've heard, I'm not a body, I'm a soul. But we really don't practically understand the ramifications. We don't know how to live as a soul. When you start to understand the ramifications and put it into practice, it is totally life-changing. If you actually live as a soul, so much prejudice is simply based on the physical body. And we tend to look at the body, not the soul. When you start to identify yourself as a soul, you'll see others as soul, and you can treat people totally differently. Your whole relationship changes. It's a totally different world to live in. And so, you know, people talk about spiritual, and they may not even realize they're spiritual beings, or they may realize it, but they may not act it. So in the Bhakti course, we help people integrate spiritual practices and principles every moment of their life, in every relationship, in every activity. It's not that you can only do it when you meditate or when you do yoga or when you're studying spiritual literature or you're in the Sangha or Association of Spiritual People. It's meant to be taken and applied everywhere. And that's why we call the Bhakti course living as a spiritual practice. Such a nice idea, isn't it? Life itself is a spiritual practice. So.
There's one more thing.
Okay.
We're getting a few questions here also from our audience. And they're asking about the cost. What is this going to be something that people will have to pay for? Is it free? How does this work if someone wants to take the Bhakti course?
The course is priceless. We're having a very difficult time putting a price on it. So now what we've done, we decided that we want to take the traditional position, at least for now, as long as we can take it. We want to take the traditional position of teachers in traditional societies. In traditional societies, teachers were supported by the people they taught. There were no fees set. They said their duty was to teach, to give knowledge. That's the duty of a teacher. It actually is said that if a teacher has knowledge and they don't give it, that he loses the realization of the knowledge. So it's his duty to give it. And so what we decided is that we would give the knowledge, and this is in the live courses, we would give the knowledge in the live courses for a $20 registration fee, which would just pay for the rental of the room and the spiritual food that we're going to be distributing, and another cost to print the materials, because you'll get notebooks and handouts. So if you register, you pay the $20 fee. And so that will cover those costs. And then at the end, you make a donation to the teacher or teachers based on the value you got from the course and what you can afford. So, but for the online course, we had to set a fee because the online course has inherent other expenses that the live course doesn't have in terms of leasing the software and other aspects that integrate with the software. So we have to charge a little. I'm not sure what that fee will be. approximately about $199 or something. It'll be about $100. And so what
we're negotiating still with the software suppliers.
We're negotiating with the software suppliers.
Get the price down as low as we can.
So the thing is that we have many courses which we want to teach, and the development of I probably spent about 2 months developing the Bhakti course, and it's not finished, and that's just level one. So it requires a tremendous amount of time, and the only way that we can feasibly do this to develop and deliver courses that are really going to make a difference in your life is we the teachers who do it have to be supported by the teaching. Otherwise, they won't have time to do it. And we're talking about a list of 5 or 6 other courses. So it's really a full-time service for the teachers. So we know we don't want to limit anyone who couldn't afford to pay what we would normally ask. And at the same time, we're a non-profit. So we also hope that those who can't afford more will give more in the mood of we're supporting your work. And by supporting this work, those who can't afford much, they can take the course and we can expand it.
For the online courses, will there be some way for people to get a scholarship or be sponsored to take the course if they don't have the funds themselves?
It's possible. That scholarships will be, Pancharatna is asking, will scholarships be available for the online course? It's possible scholarships will be available. That's our intention, and that depends on donations we receive for Bhakti Life. So as Bhakti Life develops and more donations come, then we will have a fund for those who can't afford to take the course. So if you require a scholarship, you can request that. Other questions people are asking?
Okay, I'm reading from some here. Bhaktin Carol asks, she tells us about desire, and she's thinking, if we don't have any desires, we would just lay in bed and just, you know, starve to death. So don't we need desire just to live?
Yeah, nothing is bad, and everything potentially is good, and everything potentially can be bad. So desire can be good, and desire can be bad. Earlier I was talking about bhakti as being an inherent condition of the soul, bhakti meaning devotion or love. So love is a desire. And when we manifest love, we may manifest it or show that through other desires, desires to help people, desires in ways we show affection to others, and showing affection and service to God. So, just like happiness, we're talking about happiness. Is it bad to be happy? No. But it's bad to be happy in a way that causes you distress. Some happiness, the happiness of a drunkard, destroys his life. So in that sense, happiness is bad on that level. So desire, if your desire is creating your own, if you're harming yourself through your own desire, those desires are bad. If your desires are pure, they're spiritual, like the desire to be kind or compassionate. Nothing wrong with that. But when you take it to the spiritual level, it's the full fulfillment of kindness, of compassion. So in your heart, you have that seed of pure spiritual desire. And bhakti is the awakening of that desire. And that is the desire of your heart that will satisfy you. That is the, now I'm happy.
So I'm looking here to see if there are any other questions. And there's one here about books. Are there things that you know, materials, like when you take a course, usually there's some textbooks you have to buy, or there's some other costs aside from whatever to the teachers.
If you take the course, then all the materials are provided. And if you take the online course, there'll be many downloadable materials, including audio and video. So everything is there, and all the materials are relating to the course topics, and they'll reference other teachings from other philosophers and philosophies and scriptures.
Just, I think this might be a good time to recap what we've been talking about for people who have just joined us. We're talking about the Bhakti course, and Mahatma is telling us about a little bit what this is going to be like. It's going to be offered fairly soon. I'm Pancharatna, and I'm working with him to try to support the technical side, especially how to get this all set up and running online and in other other venues. And
well, let me mention a little something that I haven't mentioned because this is being recorded, and if you've come late, you'll also be able to get the recording on Krishna.com of this show. One of the things that I think most of us are aware of and we notice is that it's very easy to practice, to take to a spiritual practice, but not really understand it well, not really practice it well, and it becomes kind of a robotic, mechanical process. Some people who do meditation find in their meditation or their chanting, it becomes very mechanical, very external, or you'll find people who go to church, but you don't, or a temple or mosque, but you don't really see a change in the way they live. They don't really seem any different than atheist or an agnostic. You line them all up, look at their lives, they all look about the same. Look at how they deal with people, look at their attitudes, not a whole lot different. So this is a big problem. So part of what we're doing in the bhakti course is to go very deep into the really essential aspects of all traditions, spiritual traditions, beyond the customs, the rituals, and the history that developed after the great teachers left this world. So you could imagine what it would be like if there was a meeting with Lord Krishna, Lord Buddha, Lord Jesus, Muhammad, Moses, and they all sat down together and they were giving what we call in Sanskrit darshan, where you get to see them and ask them questions and they're discussing. Right? Do you think they'd be fighting? Do you think they'd be disagreeing about who God is and what the teachings are? I don't think any of us would think that like that. Although you get the heads of these religious traditions now together now, there'd definitely be some strong disagreements, if not some yelling and screaming at one another. So if you take the pure essential teachings beyond what the customs and traditions which society has placed upon them through osmosis over the years, That's what we want to get to. You know, what is really spiritual life about? What are the essential spiritual practices, and how can we apply them in our life? Because that's the real key there, is the application. You know, there's a saying, knowledge is power. Any of you heard that saying, knowledge is power? It's not true. It's the implementation of knowledge that is power. So many of us know, we know many things that we don't do. So what's the use? Oh, yes, I know I'm spiritual. I know who God is and so on. But how does that translate in our lives? So the Bhakti course goes deep into that so we can spiritualize our lives and understand how to do that in the easiest way possible. And we offer many powerful meditations, visualizations, exercises, writing, journaling, discussion, sharing. So you can probe and introspect and look at these topics in a way that's relevant to you and start solving problems that you face in your life from a spiritual point of view. You know, peace of mind, happiness, issues with anger, resentment, envy, all these can be solved through spiritual practice. So that's why I'm excited about the course, because it's so valuable. It goes right to the essence. So we have more questions?
Well, we have one asking about the website for the course, and because that's my area, I'll just have to say that our website is bhaktilife.org, but it's still under construction. It's almost there, and it will be ready for the new registrations in about a week.
Oh, one week. Bhaktilife.org. You want to type that in?
I'll type it into bhaktilife.org. Our chat people here. Bhaktilife.org.
Yeah, this conversation we're having now is probably going to be on bhaktilife.org.
It will be, yeah. So I think we should give some time for you to discuss your week's topic.
Maybe I'll... We'll talk about the mind in the bhakti course, and we'll talk about it tonight.
Thank you, Mahatma.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Pancharatna. So, welcome everyone. I was gone for a few weeks, and next week I'm going to Guyana to do a Japa retreat. So if any of you like mosquitoes, come and fly over to Guyana. Actually, there's no room left. I think there's only room for 40 devotees, so if you haven't already registered, then it may be too late. Okay. So, Homer, welcome Homer. Homer has never been with us before. So, we have been, you may remember, we've been talking about the mind. And of course, in Krishna consciousness, the whole point of Krishna consciousness is to remember Krishna. So I want to tell you a story that I just heard today. And the moral of the story is really, really wonderful. There was a lady who has been in touch with me, a devotee, who I believe is either a nurse or doctor, and she was working, I believe the way the story goes, is she's working for the World Health Organization. She lives in India, and she was sent to Sudan. And when she got there, it was a very horrific experience for her because of the mass numbers of homeless people and the disease, the rampant disease, starvation, and so forth. And after 2 weeks, she had become so depressed, she decided she couldn't stay there. So she was going back to her office to let them know that she wants to go back to India. She can't do this. And she found a matchbox on the ground. And on the matchbox was a picture of Krishna. She didn't know it was a matchbox. She just saw this picture on the ground. She was looking down. That's what you do when you're depressed, right? You look down. So she was looking down and saw this picture of Krishna. And she had a transformation when she saw this picture. And it gave her so much hope and so much happiness to know that Krishna was coming to her in her distress. And she felt so relieved that Krishna knew what was going on in her life and that he would come. So she saw Krishna coming to her in the matchbox. And so she began to think very deeply and very fondly of Krishna's mercy. And then she said something which I thought was so nice. Because she realized that in her depression, she was forgetting Krishna. And that moment that she remembered Krishna, everything changed. And then she realized, she said, you know, we are only one thought away from being with Krishna. And I thought, what a nice meditation. We are only one thought away from being with Krishna. Isn't that nice? So, no matter how difficult our life is, no matter what's going on in our life, no matter how confused we are, upset, depressed, angry, whatever it may be, we are only one thought away from associating with Krishna. And Krishna can come into our consciousness in one moment. So that's a nice meditation. I was reading yesterday, no, a few days ago, I was reading some of Srila Prabhupada's letters. And these letters were about chanting. And a common question devotees ask about chanting is, are we supposed to think of Krishna's qualities and pastimes, or are we just supposed to hear his name? Because we're often told we're just supposed to hear. And so sometimes it becomes confusing. Well, if I'm thinking of his pastimes, or if I'm thinking of his qualities, maybe it means I'm not hearing anymore, I'm distracted. So Prabhupada said, no, he said, actually the whole point is to always remember Krishna, and remembering Krishna means to think of his name, his qualities, his pastimes. So he said, the more we become absorbed in his quality, thinking of his qualities and pastimes, the better. That's how we're supposed to think. So when chanting, we should become more and more absorbed in thinking of Krishna. So he was just emphasizing the point, which is made by Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Devotion, that somehow or other, think of Krishna. That the purpose of all rules and regulations is to think of Krishna. So for us as devotees or practitioners of bhakti, when we talk about controlling the mind, it's not a kind of an impersonal state of equilibrium where we're just free from desire. It's not like that at all. Although for some people, that's all it is. But for us, it's absorption in Krishna. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that when you chant the holy name, you should meditate on the qualities of the names. You should meditate on the goal of your chanting. What's the goal of your chanting? Radha Krishna's lotus feet. And you should meditate on the meaning. So if you're meditating on these things, this is absorption of the mind in thinking of Krishna. What's the meaning? Oh Krishna, please engage me in your service. Please free me from Maya's service. This is the meditation. So, now, okay, so we have any questions here? No, okay. So, I was reading something last week about the mind, which I would like to share with you. Kind of interesting concept. And this comes from yoga psychology, predominantly it's coming from Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, because the Yoga Sutras were aimed at helping people control their mind. But really we know, and I think Patanjali also makes this point, that the purpose of controlling the mind is not to control it for its own sake, but to control it so that we will not be deviated from Krishna. Because obviously if the mind is very much controlled by the lower modes of nature or controlled by lust and anger and so forth, we can't think of Krishna. So the idea of bringing the mind to a neutral state is only so that it's easier for us to think of Krishna. So in there he explained that the mind is like clay. So what does that mean? Mind is like clay. So the mind can be easily molded. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, if you look at your mind, you'll see how often your mind changes from morning to noon to evening. You know, you may be kind of wake up kind of happy, and then later in the day you kind of a little miserable or slow or tired or not so energetic, and your mind's kind of dragging. And maybe in the evening, again, your mind changes. So the mind is adapting, like clay. And one of the things that it's adapting to is the environment in which it finds itself. So the environment which we are in is affecting us. And we had talked a little bit about samskaras, and samskaras are impressions placed in our heart which affect our consciousness. So the environment we're in is affecting our consciousness. And it is said that environment is stronger than willpower. And you know, you hear some blasting loud music and you just can alter your consciousness in a second. Or you hear some soothing music, it alters your consciousness. So you see black has an effect on you. You see light purple. They say light purple is very soothing. Paint your walls light purple. It'll calm you down. Does anyone out there paint their walls black? I've never been in a house with black walls. Maybe a teenager's room, maybe. But you imagine living in a house, you go home, and every wall is black. How would you feel when you got in there? Probably feel a little black, maybe, I would think. So environment has a very powerful effect on us. And by the environment, impressions are made in our heart, and those impressions are altering our consciousness. So how do we control that? Well, we control it by processing what is coming to us through the use of buddhi or intelligence. So there are impressions all around us every day due to what we're seeing, due to what we're hearing, due to people that we're hanging out with. As you know, certain people affect you in a very positive way, and certain people have a very negative effect on you. But ultimately, it's how we process that association, how we process that environment. So what do I mean by this? Well, we're processing it through intelligence. So an impression comes upon us. How do we react to it? Well, that reaction will be very much dependent on our knowledge, on how enlightened we are. So we've talked before a lot about dealing with people who don't deal kindly with us. And one of the things that we see, which is quite normal, is that when someone is not nice to us, we get upset. And often we are not nice to them. We reciprocate their unkindness with further unkind acts. It's kind of normal for most people. So if we understand that we process everything through intelligence. So the samskara, or the environment, is throwing something at us which is negative. And then the intelligence, if the intelligence is not clear, then we process it through the idea I should get back at this person for how they've treated me. Or we just become completely upset. If we process it through proper Krishna conscious intelligence, there are a number of ways we can deal with it. Bhagavatam says, well, whatever happens, we deserve worse. That's one way of processing it. Te nukampam sushimikshamano. That I will tolerate whatever comes to me, thinking that Krishna has reduced the reactions to my sinful activities and I actually deserve worse. That's one way of processing it, based on proper intelligence. Another way of processing it is, this person now is testing me. Do you know that story? Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was not friends with the person, but there was a person who used to criticize him. And this created this huge conundrum for his disciples, because Bhaktisiddhanta never stopped this person from criticizing him. And his disciples didn't know how to deal with it. So one day they came to him with what they thought was very good news, the news being that this man had just died. And they thought he was going to be really happy about it. He was very upset. And they inquired, this man was always criticizing you, why are you upset? And he said, because he was my friend. He was my well-wisher. He was always helping me by criticizing me. I mean, how many of us think that way? Not only do we not think that way, we may even wish that that person would have died because they're causing so many problems for us. So that's an example of processing through intelligence. There's a saying, people would rather be ruined by praise than helped by criticism. We'd rather be ruined by praise. Isn't it nice when everyone praises us? Do we like criticism? No. So when we're criticized, we become upset. It creates a samskara, an impression. And that impression often turns to upset, anger, or a host of other negative qualities and emotions. What's another way to look at this? This person has come to me, they're causing some upset in my life. Another way to process it through buddhi is, I need to go through this to become stronger, to become more tolerant, to become more compassionate. There's a saying that our enemies teach us compassion. Because your friends don't really teach you compassion, if you think about it, do they? Because you're already compassionate to them. They're not teaching you how to be compassionate. It's your enemies who teach you compassion, because they're the ones that make it most difficult for you to be compassionate. So an impression comes, and according to our intelligence, how we process it, our buddhi, the mind gets molded, and it creates a samskara. So now I can create a positive samskara through a so-called negative experience. Or I can create a negative samskara through a so-called negative experience. So this is how the environment is conditioning us. And then when we create these impressions, these are like dents in a stone. And so they mold our consciousness. And now we will repetitively tend to act in the way we respond to what's coming on around us. That is good if we react properly, and that is bad if we don't. And as you well know, we all tend to do the same things daily, react in the same ways to the same situations. And so, by use of intelligence, we can create new samskaras, new impressions, which cause us to act differently. These impressions we talked about in the previous course, in how we relate to the opposite sex. There is an environment in which we may be in the presence of the opposite sex, and there is a way we process it. And the way we process it creates a samskara, an impression, which causes us to further process it in a similar way in the future. So if we want to change the mind or change the impression, we have to change the way we deal with the situation, reprogram our minds. And so what Krishna consciousness is all about is reprogramming it in a Krishna conscious way, so we naturally act that way. Now you see this in advanced devotees. It looks like if you're ever around advanced devotees, it looks like they're kind of predisposed or preconditioned to Krishna consciousness. They just naturally react to situations in a Krishna conscious way, almost as if they're naturally being propelled in Krishna consciousness. But that's because they've conditioned themselves that way through the proper use of intelligence. So then Krishna consciousness becomes easy because your natural response to situations will be Krishna conscious. Then we saw this with Srila Prabhupada. He would take morning walks with his disciples and he would look at things and point out things and he would give some Krishna conscious conclusion or siddhanta. You know, he would see birdstool on the ground all falling in one spot. And he would say, what does this mean? And they'd look at the birdstool on the ground. And they couldn't understand. And he'd say, this means that even the bird is attached to his home because he lives on that branch. And that stool is coming every day. That's his stool room, that branch. He said, even the bird is attached. So Prabhupada would be that way, that everything he could see in a Krishna conscious way. So if we see repetitive activity in our lives, which is not helping us in Krishna consciousness, which is something we would like to change, first we have to recognize that that impression or nature or attitude, samskara, is there, and that's why we continually react in the same way, and it needs to be changed. We need to reprocess everything through the use of intelligence. What else affects our samskaras? Well, what we do, how we act. You probably notice that how you act affects your consciousness. So that's why Prabhupada would always say, be engaged in Krishna's service. No matter what a devotee would do, he would always say, just continue engaging in Krishna's service because it's transcendental. It's going to purify us. So actions within the modes of nature reinvigorate those modes. If we act in ignorance, it propels itself. It's a domino reaction. So at least we want to try to act in goodness, but beyond goodness, we really want to be engaged, as Prabhupada would say, 24/7 in Krishna's service. So what we're doing, you know, just one little action can alter your consciousness. One little choice to go left or right can have a traumatic and dramatic effect on your consciousness because of the environment that you're putting yourself into and the consciousness which is generated by those actions. Actions of passion create more passion. And the more we're in passion and ignorance, the more difficult it is to be Krishna conscious. I had this experience in teaching about japa. And one of the things I realized to be a tremendous obstacle for devotees is that in the japa programs and japa workshops, and if you've attended any of the courses in Krishna.com, you've learned these principles. You can learn the principles of what to do. Okay, sit this way. Adopt this specific attitude, chant in a proper environment, create an internal environment. So many things you can do to improve your chanting. But the problem is, if your life is in the mode of passion, if your activities are in the mode of passion, then when you sit down to chant, your mind is in the mode of passion, and it's extremely difficult for you to chant. So even though you know what to do, you're finding it difficult to do it. And oftentimes you have to chant like for an hour before your mind calms down, before you get out of passion into the mode of goodness or transcendental mode. So for devotees, we want to avoid activities as far as possible in the mode of passion and ignorance. Why did Prabhupada tell us not to eat onions and garlic? We think, well, what's the big thing? Onions and garlic is just, you know, these are tamasic foods. They disturb the mind and senses. They actually disturb it. They're foods of a lower quality of nature. When you take them in your body, it affects your consciousness. One simple action, just eating a certain food, has such a dramatic effect on your consciousness that it disturbs your mind. So activities of passion or ignorance create more passion and ignorance. And so then again, we're creating certain type of samskara, impression in our consciousness. So then it works against us. So we said environment, what we see, what we're surrounded by, is creating samskara, samskaric impressions, and then also what we do. Then, of course, we bring in our own samskaras from our past karma, some of which are so fundamental we can't change because they deal with our very essence, our dharma, our vocation, our ashram, according to our past activities. You know, a lot of times in Vaishnava traditions, when someone wanted to take sannyas, they would do their astrology because if they were actually a sannyasi, they could see it because of their past karma. They could look and say, yeah, there's renunciation all the way through. So there's past samskaras from what we've done in past lives that we bring in through our karma that establish kind of a foundational nature which we have, which is more difficult to change and will change over longer periods of time. So we're talking here about what we have control of. We have control of what we do and we have control of how we process what comes to us. And what we do and how we process what comes to us is going to affect our consciousness. And if we affect our consciousness negatively and then we try to practice Krishna consciousness, it's like we're really paddling uphill. We're really making it difficult on ourselves. So what we want to do as devotees is create a proper environment that is supportive of our bhakti and then process what's around us. Oh, there's somebody I don't like. I just look at the person and say, that person has done things to me that have disturbed me, upset me. And so now this impression is coming in my heart of resentment or envy or whatever it may be. Could even be hatred or anger. We need to process it through buddhi so that samskara doesn't impress our heart. Because actually, if you think about it, it's quite easy to see how this works in every situation. And in every situation we're in, we're subjected to these impressions. But we do have control of how these impressions are affecting us. A lot of times, one of the things that I've seen you can do is when you're in public places, sometimes you're in public places and maybe it's a little disturbing, it's crowded, or you're surrounded by people who are smoking, drinking, whatever, and it's not a really nice environment for you. You can just think like Prahlad Maharaj and just pray for these people that somehow or other they'll become Krishna conscious. And just understand how much they must be suffering. When you see people with bad habits, and you think, oh, this person must really be suffering to be smoking, to be drinking, to be yelling and screaming at his wife or at her husband. And so you could be thinking, oh, yes, this material world is very difficult. And everyone is struggling with their senses. And this person also must be struggling. So in that way, instead of creating these negative samskaras about people because of their bad habits or what you feel to be bad association on you, you can be more compassionate upon them. You can think of pray to Krishna to help them and think of their welfare. And then so you don't get that negative impression. So, does anyone have any questions? What are sattvic activities? Well, first if you read Bhagavad Gita, several chapters where Krishna describes, but anything anything of a higher quality. Well, of course, there's eating in Satvagun. Of course, we eat prasadam, but even though it's prasadam, we don't want to, you know, like, okay, manjesh, if you eat a lot of chili, that's rajasic, that's passionate food. Foods which are very spicy, very rich. Sleeping too much, that's a tamasic activity. Over-endeavor, making your life extremely complicated. Always wanting more, working for more, and no end to wanting. That's passion. So I would like for a devotee is a life of simplicity. It's a life of honesty, integrity. It's a life of developing spiritual qualities. Who could say? Who could say out there? What would we consider more sattvic activity? Anything in Krishna consciousness is really transcendental, but mode of goodness and transcendental often overlap in some ways. Developing qualities, higher qualities, divine qualities, at least practicing them. Serving others with Krishna. Bhagavad Gita is full of it. How does Prabhupada describe goodness? He describes goodness as activities which are illuminating, which bring knowledge, which bring happiness. They're not activities which are agitating. He often describes goodness as the philosopher, the scientist, people in knowledge, the artist, maybe, sometimes. What are some passionate activities we do? Well, sports, watching sports, that's pretty passionate. One devotee said, actually it's ignorant because it's a waste of time. Intoxication is ignorance. You could say overeating is passion. Charity, sacrifice, going to temple, cleanliness, yeah, cleanliness would be an example. Here's a really nice point. I think this will help you, Manjesh. Okay, here's a nice example. There's a story in which Srila Prabhupada was walking in Mayapur and he noticed a bathroom. These were basically outhouses, little bathrooms out in, they're not really official bathrooms, but little like small huts, like a porta potty type thing, made out of bamboo or something, with a, you know, a hole in the ground as the toilet. And he noticed on one morning walking by them that they were dirty. And so he asked, why aren't you cleaning them? And then the devotee said, well, these are actually for the workers here. And, you know, I guess he was insinuating it's not important to clean them, or the workers will clean them if they want them clean. If they don't want them clean, they won't. So Prabhupada was very upset with him, and he said they should be cleaned. And then he said, the fact that you see something is unclean and it doesn't bother you means you're in the mode of ignorance. And he said, whatever you are, if you come in contact with that, because you're the same, there'll be no, you won't be out of alignment with it. So if you're a dirty person, if you're a disorganized person and you come into a dirty place, it doesn't bother you because you're already disorganized and dirty. You don't notice it. If you're a very clean, organized person and you come into a dirty place, it immediately upsets you. So the problem with being in the modes of passion and ignorance is that when we're in passion and ignorance, if we tend to live in that mode, then when we're surrounded by that mode, it doesn't make us uneasy because we're already in it. Whereas if you're in goodness, naturally there's an incongruency between passion and goodness and you feel it and it pushes you away from the passion or it pushes you away from the ignorance. So that's the problem of being in those modes. It makes it easier to stay in those modes. Because you are, whatever you are, you don't notice that you're not any, you just are that. So that's your status quo. So that's why it's important. I think it's really important for us as devotees to cultivate some of the qualities of goodness, although in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, transcend them. So our ultimate goal is not to be in the mode of goodness, but there are many qualities of goodness that are important for us, particularly being clean. It helps us. I think it also helps us to be tolerant. It helps us to be self-disciplined. These are all qualities of goodness. So now it's 9:00. This was a short class because we began by discussing Bhagavad life. So, you have any questions? It's very, a lot of these samskaras are so deeply ingrained that you may think you're clean and you're not. You may think you're peaceful and you're not. You may really not know what the standard is. So that's where Krishna consciousness comes in. As Prabhupada said, we are revolutionary clean. We are creating a much higher standard. You know, once Prabhupada said, my disciples, you will know them because they're perfect gentlemen. You know, sense controlled is goodness. Simplicity, simple eating, simple life, this is goodness. Complex life makes it hard to be Krishna conscious, for sure. Okay, so I think we'll end here. I will not see you next week, and I will see you the week after. So until then, be good, use your intelligence, and stay Krishna conscious. And don't forget, you're only one thought away from being with Krishna. Hare Krishna. Well, I'm really attached to this kirtan now. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Do you want me to go look how much it costs?